Oh, well, you don't know what that is either.
Fire water.
Yeah. Kind of. Kind of.
Dad bought it all the time when I was little, so.
Gotcha. We do have a bottle in my house as well. Although, I make blueberry moonshine. That's what I like. That's my holy water. All right. Lots to do, little time to do it. We are in the home stretch of the semester. We got one class left worth of information on state building. We will take our exam, and then we will start working on the final. The final exam will not be on Engage. Final exam will be a paper exam in person. The final exam will not be open notebook or open computer. So when we get past this exam, you're actually going to have to take notes. You're going to actually have to read. You're actually going to have to study, because the final exam is worth 35% of your final grade. Also, you have a paper that's due 2 weeks before. That's worth 20% of your grade. Do not forget about that. And, as I'm going to be saying often over the next 4 weeks, before you drop it into Engage, make sure you go on ProfessorLomanic.com. Make sure you read it from top to bottom, then from bottom to top, and then top to bottom again. Make sure you understand how you are being graded. I am absolutely dead serious when I say I am not grading it like an English professor. Why? I am not an English professor. But instead, the assignment is based on following directions. That's why I let you pick whatever you want to write about. That's the easy part. The hard part is following directions. And for every aspect of the directions you do not follow, you will be penalized. And I kid you not, I have grades on these papers from kids who are awful at writing, and they end up with like a B minus. Why? Well, they got the maximum penalty on grammar and spelling mistakes, but they followed all the rest of the directions. And then I've had students that were solid writers, but you know, they didn't follow directions, and they ended up with Fs. And if you look at the grading scheme, it is possible to lose so many points, you end up with negative points. So you do not want to do that to your average. Make sure you follow the directions. And if there is anything on there you do not understand, please ask me. I know many of you are shy and you don't like speaking up in class, and that's fine. But your grade is on the line, so don't assume you know what it is. If you are unsure, ask me in class. Because I can guarantee you, if you don't understand something, other people won't as well. That being said, are there any questions? All right. So, we're in England, and we got one last little bit of information. Would have liked to have finished it last class, but hey, it's an important event, and I didn't want to just kind of power through it in 3 minutes. We had a situation where England had a civil war. Tens, hundreds of thousands of people died, going all the way back to the 1640s. Then you had the interregnum, Oliver Cromwell, more people died. There was wholesale violence. But after two generations of death, chaos, and destruction, Parliament decided to try to heal the country. They brought back the monarchy. And they had a king that was willing to collaborate. And for the most part, the reign of Charles II was successful. But he did not do what Henry VIII did. He did not focus on dynasty. So when he died, he had no legal heir. So the throne passed to his younger brother, James. James was a Catholic. James was an absolutist. James believed in divine rights of kings. James ignored Parliament. James stirred the pot. James built a standing army in violation of Magna Carta. James appointed his buddies to positions of power and punished those who disagreed with him. And then, lo and behold, even though he had two Protestant daughters from his first wife, his second wife gave birth to a son who was baptized a Catholic. So, not wanting to see religious wars erupt, because again, now we're in the 1680s. The 30 Years' War was over, but history books were being written, and people were reading those books about the violence that took place in the 16th and early 17th century. And you know what they said? We don't want that. We don't want to do the whole Catholic versus the Protestant thing. So in the end, what they decided to do is to launch a revolution against the crown. Parliament decided to pull into England James's daughter, who technically would be next in line, because she is the oldest. Remember, England did away with it. It has to be a male. That's what the Catholics do. But to get her being married, Parliament also had to invite her husband, William. Why? Well, William had been serving as the Duke of Orange, which was the leader, the highest ranking leader in the Netherlands. As being the leader of this country, he could essentially raise an army. So, William would gather together his forces at the invitation of leading Protestant officials, nobles, members of Parliament, and essentially, he invaded England in November 1688. James, coincidentally, had an army that outsized the Dutch forces. They were better equipped. They were better trained. But the problem that James had was many of the generals, the leaders of the army, were Protestants. And they defected to William's side, because they didn't want him as king anymore. So essentially, having no force, no army, he lost his nerve and fled to France. His cousin Louis IV would set up him up in a palace, and there he would live out the rest of his days. The Glorious Revolution is a bloodless coup d'etat. Not a single person died. But it was significant historically speaking, because the people essentially rejected their leader and fired him. By the way, this precedent is the mechanism behind our founding fathers' desire to elect our chief executive and only allow our chief executive to serve for a period of time, a set term. You get somebody in office, you give them 4 years, and if you don't like them, you fire them. But you don't raise armies. You don't perpetrate civil wars and bloodletting and destruction. You just say, you fight it. Well, once James abandoned the throne, Parliament then voted to give the crown to both William and Mary. Now, Mary could have served as sovereign. Parliament would have granted that to her. But Mary essentially told Parliament, no, the only reason why my father is gone is because of my husband. So England would do an unprecedented thing. Never happened before, never has happened since. Parliament named them both co-sovereigns. They were equal in their authority. Then, as sovereigns, one of the first significant pieces of legislation that they agreed to, which was based upon all of the issues going all the way back to her grandfather's reign, Charles, William and Mary would sign one of the most significant pieces of the English system, known as the Bill of Rights. Although not to confuse it with the first 10 amendments to our Constitution. So to make it simple, you can remember this as the English Bill of Rights. This document would transform the nature of the English governmental system as much as Magna Carta did. And it would forever prohibit the establishment of an absolute monarchy in England. The sole purpose was to limit the power of the crown and both sovereigns agreed. And by the way, every single king or queen since has signed the Bill of Rights, acknowledging these limitations. Believe it or not, even King George III did. So what type of limitations? Well, there are a whole bunch of clauses, but I'm going to give you the big ones that I want you to know. First and foremost, no suspension of laws. The crown essentially could not cancel any law that was on the books. By the way, side note, this is a precedent. Because essentially forevermore, the king or queen of England has to follow the law. Just like everybody else in the land. The king is not greater than the law. The law is above the crown. Two. No taxation without Parliament's consent. No taxation without Parliament consent. Three. No standing armies. No standing armies. Four, freedom of speech will be protected. Freedom of speech will be protected, including the right to criticize the crown.
No suspension of laws, no taxes, no standing army, freedom of speech.
A whole bunch of individual rights. So this was meant to protect every man and woman in England. And they're going to sound familiar to you. Trial by jury. Trial by jury would be enshrined in the law. So when you screw up, you commit, or at least the government accuses you of a crime, it's not the government that decides whether you're guilty or not. It's a jury of your peers. Habeas corpus. We talked about that previously. So if for some reason the government actually does arrest you, You have a right to go before a judge.
And the government has to prove they have a reason to keep you.
Similar to our Eighth Amendment, no excessive punishments. No more beheadings, no more setting people on fire, no more putting them on the rack and stretching them until their spine breaks.
All of those medieval tortures, no more.
And the last individual right, everyone has a right to petition the crown. So to put that in simple modern speak, if you have a problem, you can send the office of the White House an email and complain. And when the White House gets that email, they can't send the men in black to make you be disappeared.
So, individual rights, trial by jury, habeas corpus, no crazy punishments, right to petition the crown.
Two more big ones. No king or queen could be members of the Catholic Church. No king nor queen could be members of the Catholic Church. And yes, all of these things are still the law of England.
And lastly,
the Act of Supremacy, which made the king's head of the Church of England suspended forever. There was a separation of the church from the crown. Do I need to repeat it?
So what did this do to England? Well, today, we refer to England as being a constitutional monarchy,
which essentially means there are rules that even the crown must follow. The king is not absolute.
Question.
Now, by the way, I can't really use modern, like, left versus right or liberal versus conservative.
But essentially what England became as a result of this century was a monarchical system where the crown essentially became a figurehead. This would give rise to parliament. This would give rise to the importance of elections. Because essentially, it would be the elected officials that would make the decisions of the state. This would make it, I guess, the most liberal side of the political spectrum. Well, if this is the liberal, what's the most conservative? What happened in France?
And the weirdest thing is, all the stuff that we just covered was going on in England. The stuff that we're going to cover now was happening in France. The shift to the most powerful absolutist monarchical system began with the death of Henri IV.
Just like the shift to constitutional monarchy began with the death of Elizabeth.
On May 14th, 1610, Henri VII, who was en route leaving Notre Dame Cathedral after his second wife was crowned queen, the king's coach
got stuck in traffic trying to get back to the palace. A madman by the name of François Revalier, who at the time was believed to be working with the Jesuits, got himself up on the coach, ripped open the door, lunged into the carriage, and stabbed the king several times in the chest. Now, the rumor was the Jesuits sent him because they were mad when Henri passed the Edict of Nantes to end the religious tensions in France. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. Because similar to what happened to Henri III when he was stabbed, the guards dragged Revalier out of the carriage and basically killed him with the help of the mob. The people of Paris actually loved Henri IV. But no worries. No worries. Unlike Charles II, Henri IV did his kingly duty. He had several children, the oldest of which was Louis, who shortly after his father's death would be crowned king at the age of 9 years old. Now, just to give you a little backstory, Louis's mother was, as I said, Henri's second wife. Her name was Marie de Medici, of the Medici banking clan. She was only 25 years old when she married Henry, or Henri, who was 47. Yes, Henri slept with any woman that had a pulse, but they did have 6 kids. So there was a line of succession. The problem was, we have once again another young king. Who's going to serve as the regent? Well, the nobles, knowing their history, knowing what had happened during all the French wars of religion, basically decided, well, it would probably be best if we let the queen serve as the regent. But just like when Catherine de Medici, who was her great aunt, served as regent for François II and Charles IX, the problem was in the name. She was not French. She was Italian. So, as regent, she began messing around with French foreign policy. Going back to the wars of Charles V, France had always kind of did the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They were opposed to the Habsburgs. Well, one of the first things she did as regent is she started making favorable outreaches to the Habsburgs, both in Austria and in Spain. In fact, she would actually marry off one of her daughters, Elizabeth, to the future Philip IV of Spain. Well, this angered many of the French, even the French Catholic nobles, because they always viewed the Habsburgs as the ultimate threat to France. Plus, no offense, and I'm going to fully explain what I'm going to say, but she was a woman. At the time, women did not receive the same education as men. Plus, she came from a very wealthy, powerful, influential banking family. So she was never taught
how to have any real skills other than to be rich and to be pretty, in how to flirt to try to attract a man. So she had no governmental training. She had no governmental interest. She didn't pay attention to what was going on in France. She's supposed to control the day-to-day operations of the nation, but she's more interested in having parties and dancing and using tax dollars to buy opulent dresses, gowns, jewelry. As a result, she nearly bankrupted France. To make matters worse, whenever any of the nobles had problems with what was going on, she never tried fixing the problems. She simply just gave them more money, which further drained the accounts of France. And then, if that was not bad enough, when she suddenly realized she had no idea what she was doing, she brought in advisors to help her. From Italy. Tensions began to flare, and it appeared as late as 1660 that another war, I can't really call it a civil war, but another war could erupt in France. At that point, the now 15-year-old Louis did something unprecedented. As we have said, in French law, king cannot be sovereign until he reaches the age of majority, which was 20. Well, this 15-year-old king was paying attention to what his mother was doing. And one day, he would walk into the king's council, and he asserted control. He banished his mother from court. Why? Well, as he told all of the counselors, his mother's incompetent. His mother doesn't know what she's doing. But then he admitted something even more extraordinary. He told all of his grand council, I'm incompetent. I don't know what I'm doing. My mother never hired any tutors for me. My mother never educated me. I don't know how to do this king stuff. Plus, he also had health problems, and modern historians believed he was subject to depression before there was even any idea what depression was. So what does he do? He doesn't take control himself. Instead, he picks who he wants to be his regent. And he selects Armand Jean Duplay, who would be known to history as Richelieu. Richelieu was brilliant. Even though when selected he was a bishop, he had mastered politics. He learned how to get what he wanted by making people do what he wanted. Not by force, but through politics. And he had a track record of success. He was one of the first bishops to fully implement all of the requirements from the Council of Trent in France. He had been elected to the Estates General, where he got national attention.
And we're going to talk about the Estates General when we do the French Revolution. There, he won praise for his speaking ability, for his understanding of the issues. And there's where the king noticed him. So when he fired his mother, he brought him in. Initially, he made him Secretary of State. But in 1620, the king would promote him to cardinal. And then in 1624, he would make him the first minister of France. And then in 1629, he would give him a noble title. And he would become the Duc de Richelieu. But as first minister is where Richelieu's brilliance shined. He is an extraordinary figure in that he was completely loyal to the crown. He was the king's loyal servant. He was not self-interested. Did he get titles? Yes. Did he get palaces? Yes. Did he get money? Yes. But there's nothing surviving in the historical record that even remotely suggests that he was trying to get that stuff. The king simply gave it to him. And in fact, there's many instances where he tried refusing. And the king kind of forced it on him. Why? Well, he was committed to serving the state. He recognized something. If the king fails, France fails. And if France fails, the people fail. Rule, I don't want to even say ruling, but acting with an iron fist, he would essentially create a whole new system of politics known as raison d'état, the reason of state. The reason of state, the raison d'état, which he invented, is based on a combination of history, politics, and economics. He argued that it is the state for which the country was founded. I'm going to say that again, and then I'll explain it. It sounds awkward. But he argued that it is the state for the reason why the country was founded. In other words, there would be no country if there was not the state. And the state is reference to the government. He also argued that it is the state that only has the ability to preserve the country. And in order to preserve the country, the state and its power must expand. Country exists because of the state. The state preserves the country. And to preserve the country, the power of the state must be expanded. And who is the state? Well, essentially the state is the crown. But not a particular king. Rather, the office of the monarchy. In his mind, it didn't matter who was on the throne. But the state would surround that particular person. Now, once the crown essentially has the ability to preserve the state, it should be the crown that always makes the decisions for the state. This is commonly referred to as interest politics. So what is the interest of the state? What does the state need? What does the state hope to gain? What are the goals of the state? Well, that's determined by the crown. Why? Remember when we did that little exercise? We did the pizza exercise in here, right? Do you think we could ever find consensus? You ever think we could get everyone to agree on a single type of pizza? And even if we could agree on a single type of pizza, do you think we could agree where we're going to get the pizza from? That's the problem with democracy. Everyone's entitled to an opinion. And at the end of the day, everyone's only going to worry about what they want. But if you give all powers one, there is no need for the debate. Because the one will decide what's best. And everyone will be bound to follow. This, my friends, is the epitome of absolutism. And why should France be an absolutist state? Well, Richelieu essentially argued, human beings suck. They are selfish, they are greedy, they are spoiled, they are self-centered. And if you allow the people to decide, they will run around like spoiled children, essentially destroying the state. Hell, look at what the left-wing loons are doing today. Just a few years ago, we were being told we have to buy electric cars because we have to save the planet because we're all going to be dead in 10 years because of global warming. And now what are they doing? Well, they're burning Teslas. They're saying, the Democrats are saying, go out and buy gas-guzzling vehicles. Which goes to show you that the whole global warming thing is a bunch of bullshit. But when you allow the mobs to have power, all the mobs do is destroy. Well, how do you keep the bad tendencies of human beings in check? An all-powerful state that has the power to control and punish those who seek harm to society. And by the way, Richelieu went to town on all of the disruptive areas of society. He went after the nobles by ending feudalism and centralizing authority in the government. He got rid of religious tolerance. He attacked and leveled Huguenot towns. There would not be different religions. No, there would only be one religion. When the peasants cried about increased taxes, he sent soldiers out, shot them dead on the street. When the nobles complained, he sent the armies to the nobles' estate. Seize the land, seize the money, seize the property. And started imposing regulations and restrictions on doing business in France. Why? Well, if you're doing a side business and you're selling to maybe a country to make money that's an enemy of the state, well, you're undermining the strength of the state. So you could lose your business. You could lose your property. You could lose your ships. You could lose your bank accounts. All at the stroke of his pen. He also used raison d'etre to create what today could be regarded as more modern foreign policy. He no longer was interested in, okay, France is a Catholic nation, so that must mean we must be on the side of the Pope. That must mean we must be on the side of all the Catholic countries. Nope. It was Richelieu who aligned France with the Protestants during the 30 Years' War.
Not only did he invade the Holy Roman Empire, but he also would send French forces against the Spanish.
He also allowed French explorers to go abroad and plant the flag. It was Richelieu who approved the founding of New France. He also allowed French privateers to engage in some piracy on the high seas, seizing those big Spanish galleons. He essentially took French society as it had been and shook it up like you would do a snow globe. But of course, he got everybody mad. Peasants were mad. The nobles were mad. The judges who used to have local power were mad. Everybody was mad. But he did not care because of raison d'etat.
For 20 years, he controlled the lives of everybody in the name of the crown. And Louis XIII sat back and allowed him to rule in his name.
But then he died. In 1642, Richelieu would pass away. And when he died, Louis XIII would select as his replacement, as first minister, Cardinal Giulio Ramondo Mazzarino, an Italian diplomat known in France as Cardinal Mazarin. Now, Mazarin had spent 10 years as the Pope's representative in Paris. And it was in that role that he became familiar and friendly and would build a strong relationship with Richelieu. So much so that when Mazarin was fired, when France declared war on the Habsburgs, because the Pope was pissed, Pope was Urban VIII, Richelieu told Mazarin, stay in France. He invited Mazarin to basically join the government. And for 4 years, he studied at the right hand of the master. So, when Richelieu died, it was only evident, well, this is the guy to replace him. But that's it, studied under Richelieu. I'll go back. But unfortunately, just a few months after Richelieu died, Louis XIII would die. Jesus Christ, bless you. Sorry, this is money. If when you all become big boys and girls, you go out and you get monies because you want to make bucks, always make sure you can have a side hustle where you can make $200 simply by answering a text. Just saying.
And you know how you do that? You use this to get lots of degrees and go to something called law school, pass the bar exam, and become a lawyer. All right. Louis XIII died.
Fortunately, even though Louis XIII had his problems, had his health issues, he did the one thing that kings were supposed to do. He not only got a wife, but he procured a legitimate child, named after himself, Louis. The problem was Louis was only 4.5 years old. Now, coincidentally, he would become king in 1643, but he would remain on the throne until 1715, making him one of the longest reigning monarchs in world history.
Now, here's the catch. Even though the king did his kingly duty and gave birth, or help procreate an heir, Louis XIII hated his wife. Hated her. So much so, he almost impeached her and put her on trial for treason.
Why? Well, Anne was the daughter, his wife Anne, was the daughter of Philip III of Spain. It was an arranged marriage made by his mother back when she was allying France with the Habsburgs. Well, this essentially meant that he was the brother-in-law of Philip IV, who Richelieu would declare war on when France joined the 30 Years' War. So what's the problem? Well, when France declared its intentions to go to war with Spain, Anne, the queen, constantly communicated with her brother and sent secret messages, including intelligence on where French armies were going to go. Hated her. Had he lived a few more years, he probably would have gotten an annulment and possibly put her on trial. But he died before he could do it. But here's the funny thing. In the king's will, he said expressly, do not let her be regent. Look at what my mother did as regent. Look at what Catherine Medici did to France when she was regent. You cannot have a foreign-born queen serve as regent of France because she will not make decisions in the interest of France. She will make decisions in her own interest. But here's the thing. What's a will? What is a will?
It's for when somebody dies, it's like what they want all of their stuff and they want it to go to.
Yeah, it's a document that only becomes legal when you're dead. And it expresses what you want. Well, do you have a say anymore when you're dead?
No.
No. So even though he put in the will, no, Anne is being regent, it's now up to the nobles to decide. And what do the nobles do? Well, the nobles decide, well, we're not going to get into the whole husband-wife relationship. That's very personal. And ultimately, France has had the precedent. When you have a child king, it's best to have the queen as regent, because the queen is going to try to rule in the best interest of the kid.
But she then did something extraordinary. She knew that she could get herself in trouble.
and she did not want to disrupt the reign of her son. So her first act as regent was to appoint Mazarin as first minister. And she essentially got herself out of the picture. And ultimately, it would be Mazarin who would control France for the next 15 years or so, until 1661. But here's the problem. Mazarin was no Richelieu. First and foremost, Mazarin was Italian, not France. And second, Mazarin was not as devoted to the crown as Richelieu was. Not saying that he was self-interested, but he made decisions based on what he thought was right, not in the interest of the state. He did not practice raison d'etat. He did not practice interest politics. He just made decisions as a politician. One of the big things that he did was he not only kept France in the 30 years' war, but he escalated France's involvement. He not only sent army after army after army in, but he also began using the French central bank to give out loans to all of the Protestant countries. Most of the loans would never be repaid. So as he's spending and lending, the money is depleting. So what forced his hand was essentially he also began raising taxes. And he began taxing everything. Anything that could be taxed, he taxed. Have any of you ever been to Paris? How much walking around did you do?
A lot.
Did you, on your tours, go to where the original footprint of Paris was?
Yeah.
Or did you go to all the areas that were built by Napoleon?
I went to both.
Okay. So you know how small Paris actually was at one point.
Yes.
Paris, like most cities, actually had a wall around it at one point. Well, Mazarin allowed anybody who lived within the walls of Paris to have lower property taxes than the people who lived literally just on the other side of the wall. And in fact, if anyone had a home that could see the wall outside the wall, he quadrupled their property taxes. His argument was, well, they were stupid. They should have had a house inside the wall then. He taxed commerce. In some instances, he put taxes on taxes that were already in place. You couldn't do anything in France without it being taxed. Well, needless to say, when the people who used to not pay taxes, particularly the nobles, found themselves being taxed, and all of the merchants, and all of the commoners, and all of the peasants were taxed and taxed and taxed and taxed, he got France into a little bit of trouble. Because just as the 30 years were winding down, a rebellion would erupt, known as the Fronde. This was a series of civil wars that would last for 5 years, 1648 until 1653. It began in Paris with an uprising by the nobles over Mazarin's taxes. And then, over the next 5 years, all around Paris, both in the cities and in the countryside, groups would rise up in rebellion. But here's the funny thing. It was called the Fronde because France did not have what today we would call the Second Amendment. people in France were not allowed to have weapons. So the rebels began fighting with a children's toy called the Fronde, which is a slingshot. Initially, the rebels were winning until the French armies came back at the end of the 30 Years' War. And then Mazarin began deploying the armies. So you could sit there and have your little ping, ping, ping all you want. But when the French soldiers come in and they go,
you're going to lose. Now, Mazarin in 1653 would crush the rebellion, finally. But in doing so, he essentially not only bankrupted France, but caused France socially to be being ripped apart.
Now, the Fronde is significant because it began in Paris. And guess who could look out his window and see what was going on in his city? Well, the young king.
He was 10 years old when the Fronde erupted.
And as he watched what was going on, what caused it, what were the reactions, Louis came to realize something.
Everybody sucks. You cannot trust anyone. You cannot trust the people. They're nothing but a stupid, illiterate mob. You cannot trust the nobles. They are corrupt. They are disloyal. They are self-interested. And you know something? You can't even trust advisors because they are bumbling buffoons. So if you can't trust anybody, who rules? In 1661, upon the death of Mazarin, when the government court was gathered trying to decide who would replace Mazarin as first minister, the young king, a whole whopping 17, walked into the court and made this declaration. Up to this moment, I have been pleased to entrust the government of my affairs to the late cardinal. It is now time, however, that I govern them myself. You, pointing his hand apparently out at all of the people that were in court, will assist me with your counsels when I ask. I request and I order you to seal no orders except by my command. I order you not to sign anything, not even a passport, without my command. And I order you to render to account to me personally each day and favor no one else but me. He's basically telling them all, they better not do anything unless you get the king's personal approval. At the end of that speech, he says in France, ce que c'est les raisons d'état, et l'état c'est moi. What is the reason of state? The state is me. He would implement over the next 54 years one of the most absolutist monarchical system ever implemented anywhere on earth of any time. He would have complete control over what he referred to as his nation. He determined
the behaviors, the rights, the privileges of every last man, woman, and child living in France. And needless to say, he would become the envy of any monarch who came after him. James II wanted to be him in England. Everybody did. But here's the catch. Here's the catch. He wasn't an idiot. He was, and I'm not trying to be political, I'm not trying to be political at all, but to make an analogy, his father was like Biden. He is like Trump. He worked every single day from the moment he took over until the day he died. He famously worked 20, 22, 23, sometimes 24 hours a day. He was having his fingers in everything. Ironically, Max, when you went to France, did you go to Versailles?
Yes.
Did you go up to his bedroom?
No.
Oh, you didn't make it up to his bedroom?
No.
The only piece of original furniture that they had left in Louis XIV's bedroom in the Palace of Versailles was his desk. And the amazing thing about his desk, it was one of the old-fashioned, it had like the leather pad on it, where basically, because they were writing in quills, and that's allowed to get that soft imprint without ripping the paper. The pad, still original, was all stripped of the top layers of the leather. And all you could see is just imprints of letters after letters after letters. To say the king worked was an overstatement. He learned that the only way to run things is to actually micromanage. Because if you micromanage, no one will go against your will. In essence, no one will screw up. Because if you go against the king's will, you screwed up. And he used his worth ethic to dominate his state. He built an effective bureaucracy where every person who worked in the government was hired by him and did his bidding to the fullest. He also maintained a huge standing army, 400,000 strong. And by the way, there was no police departments then. The army was the police. And what do soldiers do that cops do not? Cops are supposed to arrest people. Soldiers are meant to shoot people. And how did he justify this power? Oh, God made me king. A lot of the pictures that I use in my slides, you know, come from stuff I find on the internet or pictures that some of my friends send me. Well, this is one of my pictures. As I was waiting in line outside of Versailles, I noticed the iron railings had adorned all over the place this image. This is the way Louis represented himself to France, as the Sun King. Why did he symbolize himself as the sun? What comes from the sun? What? All life on earth. He is symbolically telling his state, you exist because of him. What you have is because of him. What you are able to find pleasure in is because of him. Therefore, just like what would happen to earth if the sun went dark, he can do that to you. He, and only he, is answerable to God. And because he is answerable to God, you are answerable to him. And he crushed
everybody.
And he did so in a fashion that was brilliant. I hope I have him. I hope I have him. I hope I have him. Please have him. I do.
What about the nobles?
The people who, for hundreds of years, through feudalism, helped the kings rule, but they had their own independent provinces and estates, which they basically had full control over. Well, for the nobles, he essentially bankrupted them. He made it so that way they could no longer afford to live their lifestyles. He constantly held elaborate rituals where every few months, every single noble in France would be expected to send gifts to the king. He would show up with a huge entourage, 200, 300, 400 people, randomly, unannounced, at different nobles' estates. And of course, they had to give to the king a lifestyle like he would have in Versailles. So the finest clothing, the finest silks, the finest foods, and feed hundreds of people. And he would never wear out his own welcome, because he would stay as long as he wanted to. Up to the point when you probably couldn't feed him anymore. And then he would go on to the next noble's house. He also stripped them of their right to collect taxes. So not only is he making them spend, oh, by the way, Versailles Palace, one of the largest palaces ever built, that started off as his father's hunting lodge. It became massive and opulent because of Louis XIV. He annually required all of the nobles in France to contribute to some small renovations of his father's hunting cabin. So what is there today is the final product. Why? Well, if you have no money, you have no way to resist him. When he essentially destroyed the French nobility, he then replaced them with a government bureaucracy, giving rise to this word that is part of our government, where a lot of corruption occurs. Bureau is French for office.
Classique rule.
Yes, the king was in charge, but it would be the government bureaucrats that would go out and do the tax collecting, that would do the imposing of the regulations, the rules set by the crown. His bureaucracy was small, though, only about 1,000. But man, when one of these guys showed up in town, everyone stopped what they were doing, because they knew the town was going to be in trouble.
Well, what about the church? Do you think they challenged divine rights of kings? Hell no. He essentially bought the church. He made lavish donations annually to the church,
which not only kept all the French cardinals happy, but it kept the Pope happy. And so they did a quid pro quo. He bribed them. He gave them, repealed the Edict of Nantes in exchange for every single priest in France, every single mass, essentially preaching divine rights of kings.
That you, if you are French, should bow down and pray and thank God for the blessings that you have of living under your king, who loves you.
I've already told you what he did to the peasants. 400,000 soldiers. In a country that probably had a population of about 16, 17 million. And last but not least, merchants. In order to do business in France when he was alive, you had to get a business license personally signed by the king. To get a license, you had to go before the king, tell the king, what are you doing? What are you selling? Who do you want to sell to? And the king would basically say, yay or nay. And if he said nay, you have no business. If, however, he did give you a license and then he found that you were doing business in a way that he didn't like, there goes your license. Just like that. the most perfected absolutist system ever. Questions? But when you give all power to one person, there are inevitably significant flaws because no one is perfect. And in the case of the Sun King, historians agree to 4 significant flaws that I don't think are cliques. Let me check. They are not. My bad.
No checks. There are no checks and balances in the system. What happens if the king wants to do something? It is, in fact, harmful. That he's making his judgment based on bad data. Well, there's no one that's going to dare say, "Oh, Your Majesty, you might want to check your numbers." Because if you did that, you're gone. So flaw number one, no checks and balances.
So because there were no checks and balances, you needed, in order for this system to work, a king like Louis. So that's flaw number two. You needed a king that was going to work 7 days a week, 20, 22 hours a day. Because in order for the system to work, you needed a king capable of micromanaging everything. But you know the problem with that is? Louis lived too long. Louis lived too long. So by the time he died, he had outlived all of his heirs that he tried training on how to do the job. His firstborn son, the Dauphin, kind of like the Prince of Wales, the heir apparent, he died in 1711, 4 years before his father did. The Dauphin was 49 years old. But the Dauphin had a son, also named Louis, who was 29 years old, but he died a year after his father did. What about other sons? Louis had several. Unfortunately, Louis's second son, Philip, he managed, because don't forget, his mother was the sister of Philip IV of Spain. He managed to get his second son put on the throne in Spain, which is why the Bourbons are still the monarchs in Spain. And then he made his second son his heir. Well, when that occurred, a war over the Spanish succession erupted. When all of the European powers basically fought against France to suspect this emergence of France and Spain. That wasn't good. So he couldn't have his second son, and then his last son, his third son, Charles, died 1 year before Louis did, at the age of 27. So in the end, his heir was his 5-year-old great-grandson, who would become Louis XV. No checks, needs a strong king, and now you have a kid. 3. He lived lavishly. He spent and spent and spent. And as a result, he would accumulate massive debt. Bills still had to be paid in 1785, 86, 87, 88, in 1789, when the French Revolution erupted.
One of the causes of the French Revolution were taxes necessary to pay the debts accumulated by Louis XIV. And last but not least, I know I'm at the window, the wall, wars. He loved instigating wars. His reign was filled almost nonstop with France fighting anybody and everybody. And sadly, he lost most of them, which added to the debt. All right. Who wants the exam tomorrow? Exam number 3. Sorry, Max, you're only one. Who wants the exam on Saturday? Sunday? Monday? Monday it is. I'll send out an email reminder.